Five of us in that living room danced till the very last note had sounded. Chuck Berry. That was the name of the artist. The song was Sweet Little 16, so the announcer said. When it was time for bed, Gennett said she was going back to Rosina's quarters. Hema looked hurt.
I'll keep my mother company, Gennett said. I have my own bed now. There were six of us on the floor in Asmara. Having a bed for myself will be a real luxury.
The next day in the piazza, I found the Chuck Berry 45 in a record shop. I realized from the dust jacket that Sweet Little 16 was a number one hit, but in 1958. I was crushed. The rest of the world had heard this song more than a decade before I knew it existed. When I thought of how I had danced to it the previous night, it felt like the dance of an ignoramus, like the awe of a peasant seeing the neon beer mug on top of the Olivetti building. On the eve of the new school year, Hema and Ghosh took us with them to the Greek club for the annual gala to celebrate the end of winter. Gennett surprised me by saying she'd stay back and get her school clothes ready. She, Rosina, Gibru, and Almaz planned a cozy dinner in Rosina's quarters. The big band was made up of moonlighting musicians from the Army, Air Force, and Imperial Bodyguard orchestras. They could play Stardust, Begin the Begin, and Tuxedo Junction in their sleep. Chuck Berry wasn't in their repertoire. The expatriate community, back from vacations, was out in force, looking tanned. I saw Mr. and Mrs. G, who weren't really married, and the word was they'd abandoned their spouses and children in Portugal to be with each other. Mr. J, a dashing Goan bachelor who was jailed briefly for a financial shenanigan, was in full form. The newly arriving expats would quickly learn their roles. They'd find that their foreignness trumped their training or talent. It was their most important asset. Soon they'd be regulars, smiling and dancing at this annual event. I'd always thought the expatriates represented the best of culture and style of the civilized world. But I could see now that they were so far from Broadway or the West End or La Scala that they probably were a decade behind the times, just as I'd been with Chuck Berry. I watched the ruddy, sweaty faces on the dance floor, the childlike brightness in their eyes. It made me sad and impatient. Shiva danced first with Hema, then with women he knew from Hema and Ghosh's bridge circle, and then with anyone who looked keen to dance. Suddenly, I didn't want to be there any longer. I left early, telling Hema and Ghosh I'd take a taxi home. I thought of the probationer as I walked up the hill to our quarters. I'd been avoiding her. When her students were with her, she made no sign of recognition. When she saw me with Shiva, she greeted us without comment. The first time I ran into her alone, she stopped me and said, "Are you Marion?" From her eyes, I knew that nothing had changed and that her door was still open to me. "No," I had said. "I'm Shiva." She never asked again. I heard the murmur of the radio in Rosina's quarters, but their door was closed and, in any case, I wasn't looking for company. I went to bed alone, went to bed with my thoughts. I felt older than my 13 years. I woke when Shiva came home. I watched him in the mirror. He was taller than I saw myself, and he had the narrow hips and the light tread of a dancer. He slipped off his coat and shirt. His hair was parted and combed to one side when he left the house, but now it was an unruly mass of thick curls. His lips were full, almost womanly, and there was a dreamy, prophetic quality to his face. When he was down to his underwear, he studied himself in the mirror. He held one arm up and the other out. He was imagining a dance with a woman. He made a graceful turn and dip. "You had a good time?" I said. It stopped him in his tracks.
His arms remained where they were. He looked at me in the mirror, which gave me goosebumps.
"A good time was had by one and all," he said, in a hoarse voice that I didn't recognize.
Chapter 33. A Form of Madness. The taxi dropped Shiva and me across from Missing's Gate in front of the cinder block buildings just as the street lights came on. At 16, I was captain, opening batsman, and wicketkeeper for our cricket 11, and Shiva was a middle-order batsman. As opener, my forte was wailing away at the ball and trying to weather the first salvo while demoralizing the bowlers, while Shiva's strength was to doggedly defend his wicket, anchoring the team, even if he scored few runs. After practice, it was always dark when we came home. I saw a woman framed by the bead curtains and silhouetted against the light of the bar at the end of the building closest to Ali's souk.
"Hi, wait for me," she called out.
Her tight skirt and heels restricted her to mincing steps as she crossed the plank that forded the gutter. She hugged herself against the cold, smiling so that her eyes were reduced to slits.
"My, you have grown so tall. Do you remember me?" she said, looking uncertainly from me to Shiva.
A jasmine scent reached my nostrils. After her baby died, I'd seen Sige many, many times, but only at waving distance. She had worn black for a year. That rainy morning when she brought her baby to Missing, Sige had looked quite plain. Hers was a simple, guileless face, but now with eyeliner, lipstick, hair in waves down to her shoulders, she was striking. We touched cheeks like relatives, first one side, then the other, then back to the first side again.
May I present my brother?" I said.
"You work here?" Shiva said.
Shiva was never tongue-tied around women.
"Not anymore," she said. "I own it now. I invite you to please come in."
"No, but thank you," I stammered. "Our mother is expecting us."
"No, she's not," said Shiva.
"I hope you won't mind if I come another day," I said.
"Whenever you want, you are welcome, both of you."
We stood in awkward silence. She still had my hand.
"Listen, I know it was a long time ago, but I never thanked you. Every time I see you, I want to talk to you, but I don't want to embarrass you, and I felt ashamed. Today, when I saw you this close, I thought I'd do it."
"Oh, no," I said. "It is I who worried that you were angry with me. With us. Maybe you blamed Missing for..."
No, I'm to blame."
The light dimmed in her eyes.
"That's what happens when you listen to these stupid old women. Give him this, do that," they told me. That morning, I looked at my poor baby and I realized all those Habesha medicines had hurt him. When your father examined Teferi, I knew he could have helped if I had come days earlier. I'd made a horrible mistake by waiting, but..."
I remained silent, remembering her sadness and how she had cried on my shoulder.
"I hope God forgives me. I hope he gives me another chance."
She spoke earnestly, her face reflecting her feelings, hiding nothing.
"But listen, what I came to tell you is, may God and the saints watch over you and bless you for all the time you spent with us. Such a good doctor your father is. Are you going to be doctors?"
"Yes," Shiva and I said easily, speaking in unison. It was about the only thing I could say with confidence these days, and it was about the only thing Shiva and I seemed to agree on.
The light came back to her face.
As we walked to our bungalow, Shiva said, "Why didn't we go inside? She probably lives at the back. She would have let you sleep with her."
"What makes you think I have to sleep with every woman I see?"
I turned on him with more venom than was needed.
"I don't want to sleep with her. Besides, she's not that kind of woman," I said.
"Maybe not anymore, but she knows how."
"I've had my chances, you know. It's a choice."
I told him about the probationer as if to prove my point. Shiva had nothing to say to that, and we walked in silence. He was getting under my skin. I didn't want to think about Sige in that way. I didn't want to picture her sweet face and how she had to make a living. It was painful to imagine, and so I chose not to. But Shiva had no such qualms. Shiva said, "One day we'll have sex with women. I think today is as good as any other day." He looked up as if to ascertain that the arrangement of the stars was auspicious. I stopped him and grabbed his shirt. I tried to find reasons for my objection. What came out was lame. "Are you forgetting Hema and Ghosh? You think it's something that will make them happy? People look up to them. We mustn't do anything to embarrass them." "I think it's inevitable," Shiva said. "They do it too. I'm sure they..." "Stop!" I said. What a disturbing thought. But not so for Shiva. The very month we turned 16, my voice cracked when I didn't want it to. I had blackheads pushing out as if I had swallowed a sack of mustard seeds. The clothes Hema bought me grew tight or short in 3 or 4 months. Hair appeared in strange places. Thoughts of the opposite sex, mainly of Genet, made it difficult for me to concentrate. It reassured me to see these physical changes mirrored in Shiva, but after our conversation about Sige, I couldn't talk with him about the desire I was feeling or the restraint that had to come with it. Shiva felt no such need for restraint. "Prison," I'd heard Ghosh laughingly tell Adid, "is the best thing for a marriage. If you don't send your spouse, then go yourself. It works wonders." Now that I knew what they were up to, I was deeply embarrassed, even shocked. Despite our knowledge of the human body in the context of disease, Shiva and I were naive for the longest time about sexual matters. Or perhaps it was just me. Little did I know that our Ethiopian peers, both at our school and at the government schools, had long ago gone through their sexual initiation with a bar girl or a housemaid. They never suffered my years of foggy confusion, trying to imagine what was unimaginable. I remember a story my classmate Gabby told me when I was 12 or 13, a story which he'd heard from a cousin who had emigrated to America, a story which we all believed for the longest time. "When you land in New York," the cousin had said, "a beautiful blonde woman will engage you in conversation at the airport. Her perfume will drive you mad, big breasts, miniskirt. She will introduce you to her brother. They'll offer you a ride into town in their convertible, and, of course, not to be rude, you accept. As you are driving, the man will say, 'Let's just drop by my house in Malibu and have a martini before we get you to Manhattan.' You pull into their mansion, a house like you've never seen. As soon as you are inside, the man will pull out a gun and point it at you and say, 'Screw my sister or you will die.'" So many nights I lay awake dreaming of this horrible, twisted, beautiful fate, wishing I could go to America only for this reason. "Brother, put away the gun, I will screw your sister for free," became a line Gabby and I and our little gang said to one another, our secret phrase that signaled our fellowship in adolescent horniness, our simmering sexual heat. Even after we realized the story was absurd, a fairy tale, it still delighted us, and we loved to repeat that refrain. A few weeks after Shiva and I had seen Sige outside her bar, I encountered the staff probationer walking down to Missing's Gate. There was no escaping her.
Seeing her always provoked anxiety.
She was with her brood of probationers. She usually ignored me in that situation. But on this day, she smiled and blood rushed to her face. I smiled back so as not to be rude. She winked and came to me as her students walked on.
"Thank you for last night. I hope the blood didn't scare you. Did that surprise you? I waited for you all these years. It was worth it."
She brushed against me.
"When are you coming next? I'll be counting the days."
She swung every bit of flesh that would swing as she shimmied after her students, as if Chuck Berry were strutting behind her, playing his guitar. She called over her shoulder, loud enough for the whole world to hear, "Next time, please don't run off afterward like that, okay?" I raced home. Of late, particularly on weekends, Shiva went off on his own, and I hadn't given it much thought. I never imagined this is what he'd been up to. Shiva, Genet, and Hema were at the dinner table, Rosina serving. Ghosh had gone to wash up. I hauled Shiva off to our room. "She thinks it was me!" I wish I'd never told him about my dancing with the probationer. "Why didn't you ask me? I would have forbidden you to go. I did forbid you to go. What did you tell her? Did you pretend to be me?" Shiva was puzzled by my anger. "No, I was me. I just knocked on her door. I said nothing. She did all the rest." "My God, just like that? You broke your virginity and hers?" "It was my first time with her." "And what makes you so sure about her, eh, older brother?" His words were like a punch in my gut. I'd never heard Shiva speak sarcastically to me, and it felt cutting, ugly. He went on as I stood speechless. "It's not my first time, anyway. I've been going to the piazza every Sunday."
"What? How many times have you gone?"
21 times. I couldn't speak. I was stunned, embarrassed, disgusted, and terribly envious. "The same woman?" "No, 21 different women. 22, if you count the probationer." He was standing there, chin pointing at me, one arm languidly set against the wall. When I found a voice, I said, "Well, would you mind not going back to the staff probationer?" "Why? Will you visit her?" I no longer felt I had any authority over him, no credible experience with which to advise him. I felt very tired. "Never mind, but do me a favor. Tell her who you are if you go back, and stay around and hold her and whisper sweet things in her ear when you are done. Tell her she's beautiful."
"Whisper what? Why?"
"Forget it."
"Marion, all women are beautiful," Shiva said. I looked up and realized he spoke with conviction and not a trace of sarcasm. He wasn't embarrassed or angry that I hauled him off, or the least bit upset. My conceit was that I thought I knew my brother. Yet all I really knew were his rituals. He loved his Grey's Anatomy and carried it around so much it had pale indentations on the cover from his fingers. When Ghosh got Shiva a new edition of Grey's, my brother was insulted, as if Ghosh had brought him a stray puppy to replace his beloved Cthulhu, who was on her last legs. I knew Shiva's rituals, but not the logic behind them. Shiva did find women beautiful. I'd seen that from the first time we visited the Virgin Clinic. He never missed a clinic and ultimately wore Hema down until she taught him how to turn babies. There was nothing prurient about his interest in the Virgin Clinic or in obstetrics and gynecology. If the clinic day happened to fall on a holiday or Hema decided to not have it for some reason, Shiva would still be there, seated on the steps of the locked building. Here I was telling him to be nice to the probationer, but he could argue that he'd given the probationer just what she'd wanted, while I'd been anything but nice to her. Meanwhile, I was saving myself for one woman. My abstinence felt noble because it was so very difficult. I burned with my celibacy, and I wanted it to impress Genet. How could it not? It had been clear to me ever since that sunny Saturday 3 years before, when Genet returned from her holiday in Asmara, that puberty for her was all but complete. Her growth spurt that winter made everything longer, legs, fingers, even lashes. Her eyelids turned sleepy-looking, and her eyes seemed even more widely spaced. After her return from Asmara, she began to drive the household mad. According to Nelson's textbook of pediatrics, breast buds and pubic hair were the first signs of puberty in girls. How strange that Nelson overlooked the first sign I noted, namely a heady, mature scent that beckoned like a siren.
When she wore perfume, the two scents would mingle, and what emerged made me dizzy. All I could imagine was tearing off her clothes and drinking from the source. Gennett's changes galvanized Rosina. I could see that clearly. Hema and Rosina were allies, united by their desire to protect Gennett from the predators, the boys. But the two mothers were never protective enough for my tastes, and they sabotaged their own efforts by buying her the kinds of clothes and accessories that made her more attractive to the opposite sex. The hounds, judging by how I felt, couldn't help sniffing at our doorstep. And what's more, Gennett, by her own admission, was in heat. That term, on a Thursday, Gennett sent word that she wouldn't be riding back to school in our taxi. She said she'd come home on her own. As Shiva and I walked the last 50 yards up our driveway, a sleek black Mercedes-Benz dropped Gennett off. Shiva went on into the house, but I waited. "I don't like you coming back with Rudy," I said to her. It was such an understatement. That luxurious car made me feel so inadequate, and it made my blood boil. Rudy's father had the porcelain and bathroom fixture monopoly in Addis. There were perhaps 2 other kids in the school who drove their own cars. What rankled most was that Rudy had once been one of my best friends.
"You sound like my mother," Gennett said,
oblivious to my distress.
"Rudy is the crown prince of the toilets. He just wants to sleep with you."
"Don't you?" she said, looking at me coyly, tilting her head. "Yes, but I want to sleep only with you. And I love you, so it's different." For all my shyness around women, I didn't have a problem telling Gennett how I felt. Perhaps it was a mistake to show my hand so easily. It gave a shallow woman great power over you. But my faith insisted she couldn't be shallow. That such love, such commitment from me, would empower her, free her.
"Will you do it with me?" she asked.
"Of course I will. I dream of it every night. We only have to wait 3 more years, Gennett, and we can get married. And then we will lose our virginity in this place," I said, pulling out a much-folded picture I had torn out of National Geographic. It showed the Lake Palace in Udaipur, a gleaming white hotel in the middle of a pristine blue lake. "I want to marry in India," I said. I had visions of me, the groom, riding in on an elephant, a symbol of the desire and the frustration I had repressed. Only an elephant or a jumbo jet would do. And beautiful Gennett, bejeweled and dressed in a gold sari, jasmine all around. I could see every detail. I even had the perfume picked out for her, Motia Bella, made from jasmine flowers. "And this is the honeymoon suite." The flip side showed a room with a giant 4-poster bed, with huge French doors beyond that opened out onto the lake. "Notice the bathroom with a clawfoot tub and a bidet?" The crown prince of toilets could never top that. Gennett was surprised and touched by the photographs and the fact that I would be carrying that page in my wallet. My tigress fixed her gaze on me with new interest. "Marion, you've really thought about this, haven't you?" I described the white silk sheets on the bed, how the sheer cotton curtains wouldn't close it in the daytime, but at night they'd be open, as would the doors to the veranda. "I'll cover the bed with rose petals, and when I undress you, I'm going to lick and kiss every inch of your body, starting with your toes." She moaned. She put a finger on my lips, her eyeballs rolling back in her head, showing me her throat.
"My God, you better stop before I go crazy," she sighed. "But listen, Marion, what if I tell you that I don't want to get married? I don't want to wait. I want to be deflowered. Now, not in 3 years.
But what about Hema or your mother?"
"I don't want them to deflower me. I want you."
"That's not..."
A peal of laughter, for which I forgave her because it lifted my spirits.
"I know what you mean, silly. What if I don't have your strength to resist? Some days I just want to do it. Don't you? Just to get it over with? Just to know?
She sighed.
If you won't do it, maybe I should ask Shiva. Or Rudy? Not that toilet prince. And Shiva, well, Shiva is no longer a virgin. He's done it already. Besides, I thought you loved me.
What? She clasped her hands in delight and looked around for Shiva.
Shiva!
She was almost jumping for joy. She'd sidestepped the question of her love for me. She was too shy to profess it, I told myself.
Oh, Shiva, Shiva! We must get all the details from him. Shiva no longer a virgin, you say? What are you and I waiting for, then?
I'm waiting for you and...
Oh, stop! You sound like a stupid romance novel. You sound like a girl, for God's sake. If you want first shot, you better move fast, Marion.
She seemed serious, no trace of humor in her face. She scared me when she spoke that way. Otherwise, I have some others in mind. Your friend Gabby, or even the toilet prince, though his breath stinks of cheese. She burst out laughing again, enjoying my distress, but also showing me that she was just joking, thank God. I couldn't take much more teasing. It was hard to hear her mention the names of other suitors. I spied the stack of women's fashion magazines in her hands.
What's happened to you? I demanded. I was angry now.
I remembered the girl who had mastered Bickham's penmanship and who, after Zumui's death, had read books voraciously, anything that Hema fed her.
You used to be... serious, I said.
Now her best friends were two beautiful Armenian sisters. The three of them went shopping together in the afternoons, or to the movies, where they observed actors whose dress and behavior they held to be the gold standard. They kept all the boys guessing. Gennet's grades had once been so good that she skipped a grade and joined our class. But of late, she rarely studied, and her grades were average.
What's going on, Gennet? Don't you want to be a doctor?
Yes, doctor. I want to be a doctor, she said, coming very close to me.
Doctor, I want you to give me a checkup.
She held her arms apart, the book bag in one hand, the fashion magazines in her other hand. She brought her body close to mine and thrust her hips into me.
I hurt down here, doctor.
Rosina jumped out of the front door of our quarters like a jack-in-the-box. Her sudden appearance was startling, and I admit it was comical, but I didn't think that the way Gennet burst out laughing would please Rosina. In a torrent of Tigrinya, with Etelinya thrown in, Rosina screamed at Gennet and descended on us. Gennet danced around me to stay out of Rosina's reach, finding even more humor in her mother chasing her. I understood Rosina's words here and there and guessed what she was saying.
Where are your brains, and what do you think you were doing just now? Who is that boy with the car, and do you know he only wants one thing? Why are you pressing against Marion as if you are a bar girl?
Each question provoked fresh laughter from Gennet. Rosina glared at me as if I should answer for her daughter. This was the second time she'd caught Gennet and me in a compromising position. She switched to Amharic as she grilled me.
You! Why didn't she come back with you and Shiva? And what were you two doing just now? We're going to be doctors, don't you know, mother?
Gennet shouted in Amharic, tears in her eyes, barely able to speak.
I was teaching him how to examine a woman.
Rosina's shocked face was Gennet's reward, and she found this so hysterical that she dropped her magazines and her book bag, clutched at her stomach, and staggered away in the direction of their quarters. The two of us watched her sashay away, holding her sides. Rosina turned to me, hiding her dark confusion by putting on the stern look she'd use when Shiva or I had been naughty. But it felt artificial, more so now because, at 6 feet and 1 inch, I towered over my nanny.
What do you have to say for yourself, Marion?
I hung my head, took 2 shuffling steps toward her.
I want to say,
I said, and then I grabbed Rosina, lifted her up in the air, whirled her about while she beat on my shoulders.
I want to say that I am so happy to see you, and I want to marry your daughter. Put me down! Put me down!
I put her down, and she tried to slap me, but I jumped away.
You're crazy, you know that?
Rosina said, trying to adjust her blouse, smoothing out her skirt, determined not to smile at all costs.
The evil spirits have gotten into all you children.
She picked up the book bag and the magazines and retreated after Gennett, shouting for her and me to hear.
You two just wait. I'm going to get a stick and line you evil children up and beat that devil out of you.
Rosina, why talk to your future son-in-law that way? I called after her. She made to turn back and come after me, but I dodged away.
Madness! Lunacy! She said,
and stalked off, talking to herself. I looked up to see Shiva standing in the big picture window, looking out. The wind in the eucalyptus trees stirred up the kind of dry rustling sound that could fool you into thinking it was a rain squall. But the sky was cloudless. Through the glass, I could see Shiva studying me, his face flushed. Our eyes met, and his expression suggested he'd been laughing, that he probably saw and heard everything. I admired his pose, one hand in his pocket, knees locked, his weight on one leg. My brother was elegant even in the act of standing in place. It was a quality he shared with Gennett. He rarely smiled, and there was, in the tautness of his upper lip, the hint of a leer. I grinned, holding nothing back. I felt good, pleased with myself. My brother could read my mind. My brother loved me. He loved Gennett, and I loved them both. Yes, Rosina was right. Madness all around at Missing. But only a madman would want to be anywhere else. Chapter 34 A Time to Reap. The madness of that evening came at a most inopportune time. It was my last year at LTNC, and I was hell-bent on doing well in the school finals. My motivation was simple. A magnificent ivory-colored hospital, 5 times as large as Missing, had been built on a rise looking down at Churchill Road and the post office and the Lycée Français. It was to be the teaching hospital of a new medical school, to be staffed with the help of the British Council, SwissAid, and USAID. The teachers were distinguished physicians from these countries who had recently retired from long academic careers and accepted short assignments to Addis. So while Rosina went after Gennett, hauling the magazines and textbooks Gennett had dropped, and certain to continue her fight, I wasted no time. I went inside, washed up, and then spread my books out on the dining table. Hema and Ghosh were playing bridge with a few others at Ghosh's old bungalow. I ate as I studied. Every minute counted, as far as I was concerned. I'd mapped out how many days and hours and minutes remained before the school-leaving exam. If I wanted to sleep, play cricket, and get into medical school, I had no time to waste. Gennett arrived an hour later to study with me. I tried not to look up. Soon, Shiva joined us. He'd brought Jeff Coates' Principles of Gynecology to the table, and it bristled with bookmarks. Shiva didn't read books as much as he disassembled and digested them, made them appendages of his body. For Gennett and me to get into medical school, we had to get top grades in the school finals. Gennett professed to be just as enamored with medicine as I was, but she was often late joining me at the study table, and she packed it in earlier than I did. Sometimes she didn't come at all. On 2 weeknights, I took a taxi to Mr. Mammon's house for tuition in math and organic chemistry. Gennett came once, bristled at Mammon's ironclad discipline, and wouldn't go back, while I found his help to be priceless. On weekends, I retreated to Ghosh's old quarters to study, leaving Ghosh and Hema free to turn the radio on or to entertain without worrying about disturbing me. Gennett could have joined me at Ghosh's quarters, but she rarely did. Shiva didn't have any of our worries. He'd been lobbying to drop out of school altogether. He wanted to function as Hema's assistant, to
Degrees and diplomas did not matter to him. Hema was blunt. If he wanted to work with her, he'd have to finish his final year, even if he didn't take the exams. Meanwhile, on his own, he was learning everything he could about obstetrics and gynecology. I overheard Hema tell Ghosh that Shiva knew more than the average final year medical student when it came to obstetrics and gynecology. Shiva had appropriated the tool shed where we'd hidden the motorcycle. He'd learned to weld from Farinacci, and he kept his torch and equipment in there. A month or so earlier, I'd stuck my head in the tool shed and was surprised to see the back wall was visible, with no sign of the motorcycle or the wood stacks, gunny sacks, and Bibles we'd used to conceal it. "I took it apart," Shiva had said when I asked. He pointed to the base of his heavy work table. The square wooden plywood support concealed the engine block. The bike's frame he'd wrapped in oilcloth and tarp and buried under the table. The rest of the bike was stored in containers which ranged from matchboxes to stacked crates, neatly arranged on metal shelves he'd welded together.
"Tell me about it, Shiva,"
Gennet whispered from behind her book, Chemistry by Concept. She'd lasted just 10 minutes before breaking the silence and my concentration.
"Tell you about what?"
Shiva said, not bothering to lower his voice.
"About your first time, what else? Why didn't you tell me before? I just heard from Marian that you're not a virgin."
Shiva's story, which I'd been too embarrassed and envious to ask about myself, was stunning in its simplicity. "I went to the piazza. Down the side street next to the Masawa bakery, you know, where you see the rooms, one after the other? A woman in each doorway, different colored lights."
"How did you pick?"
"I didn't. I went to the first door. That was it," he said, smiling and turning back to his work.
"No, it isn't it."
She snatched his book away.
"What happened next?"
I pretended to be annoyed, but every cell in my brain was attentive. I was glad that Gennet was doing the questioning. I asked how much. She said 30. I said I had only 10. She said okay. She took off her clothes and lay on the bed.
"All her clothes?"
I blurted out. Shiva looked at me, surprised. "All but her blouse, which she pulled up."
"A bra? What was she wearing?"
Gennet wanted to know. "A little sweater, I think. A half-sleeve thing. And a miniskirt. Bare legs and high heels. No underwear. No bra. She stepped out of her heels, dropped her skirt, lifted her blouse and lay down."
"Oh, God. Go on," said Gennet.
"I took all my clothes off. I was ready. I told her it was my first time. She said, 'God help us.' I said, 'I didn't think we needed God.' I got on top of her. She helped me start."
"Did it hurt her? Were you...
erect? Yes. No, I don't think it hurt her. You know, the vagina has walls that are expansible. They can accommodate a baby's head."
"Okay, okay," Gennet said. "Then what?"
"She started to move, showing me how till I understood. I did that till I experienced the ejaculatory response."
"What?"
Gennet said. "The contraction of the vas and the seminal vesicles mixing with the prostatic secretions, he came," I explained. I'd learned the word from a scruffy little pamphlet authored by a T.N. Raman, a writer of purple prose. My classmate Satish brought these pamphlets back from his holiday in Bombay. T.N. Raman was responsible for most everything Indian schoolboys learned or misunderstood about sex.
"Oh, and after that?" Gennet said.
"Well, I got up, got dressed and left."
"Did it hurt you?" I asked.
"No pain." From his unsmiling expression, he could have been talking about getting an ice cream at Enrico's.
"That's it?" Gennet asked. "Then you paid her?"
"No, I paid her first."
"What did she say when you were leaving?"
Shiva thought about that. "She said she liked my body, and she liked my skin.
that next time she would give it to me doggy style.
What did she mean, doggy style?
I didn't know. I said, why wait till next time? Show me now.
You had money?
That's what she asked. You have money? But I didn't. She let me do it anyway. From the back was what she called doggy style. This time, I think she had her own explosion.
God,
Gennett said, groaning and sliding down in her chair, her face suffused with blood.
What's the matter with you, Marion? Where are you going?
I had risen from my chair. The scent coming from Gennett was overpowering, the air shimmering pink with it.
What's the matter with me? I was not as annoyed as I acted. How am I supposed to study here? Tell me. I can't believe you asked me that.
The matter with me was that I was terribly aroused, hearing Shiva's story, and now seeing the sultry look in Gennett's eyes, her body in touching distance, smelling her in heat, and knowing she was willing. If I didn't leave, I was going to have my own explosion in my pants. I had to leave. I shoved my biology notes into my jacket. I found Rosina standing too close to the kitchen door and now pretending some special interest in the stove. Even if she wasn't eavesdropping or lacked any sense of smell, she surely saw the pink cloud wafting out of the dining room. She avoided my eyes. Mother and daughter couldn't seem to escape each other, with Gennett determined to act outrageously and Rosina just as determined to respond, and it was difficult to say who initiated the battles. Rosina was my ally in one sense, because she kept Gennett safe for me. But it annoyed me to see her hovering in this way.
I'm going to the souk, I said gruffly.
But you just sat down to study, Marion.
I glared at her, daring her to stop me. I took my time walking down to the front gate. I bought a Coke, but then gave it to Gibru. I sat in his sentry hut. I didn't want to go home until my mind and my body were back to baseline. Gibru's long story about a troublesome nephew helped the cause. Eventually, I bid Gibru good night and I headed back. When I turned up from the roundabout to the road leading to our bungalow, I saw that there was a light on in the tool shed. Shiva worked late there many nights. Whenever I came this way in the dark, I felt dread as I neared the spot where the army man went airborne. There was a crack in the concrete of the curb that commemorated that moment when the BMW's front wheel had been arrested. The tree trunks creaked and groaned. The rustling of the leaves sounded ominous, like a hand sifting through coins. I fully expected to see the army man rise out of the darkness. After years of imagining him, I would find it almost a relief when he appeared. Shiva had no such qualms because he stayed in the tool shed late into the night. The passing years hadn't taken away from me the weight of what had happened at this spot. But the fear had become familiar. I understood what made people confess to murder years after the fact. They believed that it was the only way to cease tormenting themselves. I hurried past that turn in the road. I heard music from Shiva's radio in the tool shed. I was just past the tool shed, almost to our house, when I saw a figure come purposefully down the hill. It was pitch dark, and now I heard a muttering sound. It was talking to itself. My heart was in my mouth, but what kept me from panic was that it sounded like a woman. Only when the figure was almost on me did I see that it was Rosina. Where could she be headed at this hour? She came up very close to me, studying my face the way she often did to be sure I was not Shiva. Then, before I registered her anger, she slapped me. She was all over me, cuffing me and pulling me down by my hair with her left hand while she slapped me with her right.
I warned you!
She screamed.
Rosina, what are you talking about?
I said, cowering. This only infuriated her. I suppose I could easily have stopped her or run, but I was too shocked to react. She slapped me again.
5 minutes I leave you alone, and this is what happens? So clever, you pretending to go to the souk and she to the bathroom.
When I asked her to explain, she swung at me, and this time I turned so her blow found the back of my head.
I waited, she said. I gave you the benefit of the doubt. Then I went looking for you. I saw her coming up the hill. You sent her out first, didn't you? If she gets pregnant, what happens?
Rosina hissed in my ear.
It means she'll be a maid like me. All that English and studying books won't make a difference in her life. But Rosina, I didn't. Don't lie to me, my child. You were never good at lying. I saw you two looking at each other. I should have kept her home right then.
I stood silent, staring at her.
You want proof? Is that it?
She yelled. She reached to her waist and drew something out and flung it at me. A pair of women's panties.
Her blood and your seed.
I picked the garment off my face. In the dark, I could see nothing. But I could smell blood, the scent of Genet. And I could smell semen. It was mine. I recognized my starchy scent. No one else shared that odor. No one but my twin brother. I had no heart, no energy to do anything but to crawl into bed. I felt battered. I felt alone. Shiva came to bed much later. I waited to see if he would say anything. At some point, he fell asleep while I lay there awake. In Ethiopia, there was a method of divining guilt called lebashai. A little boy was drugged and taken to the scene of the crime and asked to point out the guilty party. Unfortunately, a hallucinating youngster's pointing finger too often stopped in front of an innocent who was then stoned to death or drowned. Lebashai was banned in the empire, but it still went on in the villages. That was how I felt. Falsely accused by the pointing finger, but unable to defend myself. What I could do was extract revenge. The guilty party slept next to me. I could have killed Shiva that night. I thought about it. I decided it would solve nothing. My world was already destroyed. My arms were dead. My brain was numb. My love had been turned into a mockery of love, into shit. I had no reason, no desire to do anything anymore. Genet didn't go to school the next day. Shiva left with Hema's reluctant permission to go with Mr. Farinacci to Akaki, to the textile factory where one of the giant dye machines had seized. Farinacci had been asked to manufacture a part, and he wanted Shiva to come and see the giant looms. I stayed in bed. When Hema came to see why, I said I didn't feel well and wouldn't go to school. She took my pulse, looked at my throat. She was puzzled. When she tried to quiz me, I said, "Never mind, I'm going." That was easier than facing an interrogation. I don't remember anything about that day in school. Ghosh and Hema had no idea what had transpired, but they knew something had happened. The door and window to Rosina's quarters were closed, and they could hear Rosina carrying on in there in a loud voice. That evening, Hema said there were three of Rosina's relatives, a woman and two men, visiting her. Hema pressed me as to what was going on. I couldn't believe that she didn't know or that Rosina didn't tell her. It appeared that no one was talking about what happened the previous night. I was sure Rosina would go to Hema and accuse me, and I couldn't understand why so far she had not. Had Hema talked to Shiva, I suspect she would have found out everything, but no one thought to ask him. Shiva returned just as we were finishing dinner, pleased with his excursion to Akaki. Neither Genet nor Rosina was at the table. Almaz said that mother and daughter were having a big fight and that Rosina's relatives had come to mediate. Hema rose to go see what was happening, but Ghosh held her back. "Whatever it is, if you get in the middle, it's only going to get more complicated." Shiva said nothing, eating his food.
I wasn't being noble by keeping quiet. I didn't think anyone would believe my side of the story. It was up to my brother or Genet to save me if they wanted to. I studied Shiva's face at the dining table. There was no sign that he was aware of the calamity he'd caused. No indication at all. That night, I told Shiva I was moving to a room in Ghosh's old quarters. I was going to sleep and study there. I wanted to be alone there, I announced, not looking at him. He said nothing. It would be the first time in our lives that we did not occupy the same bed. If there were filaments and cords of yolk or flesh that kept our divided egg sticking together, I was taking a scalpel to them. Saturday morning, when I came over for breakfast, it seemed to me that Shiva hadn't slept any better than I had. After breakfast, he left for Farinacci's. I was about to go back to my room to study when Almaz burst into the dining room. "I think you better come, madam," she said, addressing Hema. She led the charge to the servants' quarters. Hema, Ghosh, and I followed. Rosina sat in a corner of the darkened room, looking sullen, defensive, yet anxious. Genet lay on her bed, her face pale, sweat beating on her forehead, her eyes open but unfocused and dull. The room held a raw, sour odor of fever. "What happened here?" Hema asked, but Rosina wouldn't answer or meet Hema's gaze. Almaz turned on the light and she moved to block my view, then lifted the blanket to show Hema. Ghosh said, "Open the window, Merian." And he moved closer to look. "My God," Hema said. Genet moaned in pain. Hema grabbed Rosina's shoulders.
Did you just... This poor girl?"
Choking with fury, Hema shook her. But Rosina wouldn't look up.
"You stupid woman,"
Hema said.
"Oh God, God, why?"
Hema's eyes were those of a madwoman, uncomprehending, dangerous. I thought she might strangle Rosina. Instead, she pushed her away.
"You've probably killed her, Rosina. Do you know that?"
There were tears coming down Rosina's chin, but her expression remained surly. Ghosh scooped Genet in his arms, and she let out an unearthly moan as he lifted her off the bed. "The car," Ghosh said, and Almaz ran ahead to get the door. Hema followed. I lingered for a second in the doorway on the threshold of Genet's home. My nanny sat just the way she had when we came in. I thought of the day she'd taken a razor to scarify Genet's face and how her expression had been defiant, proud. But now I saw shame and fear. As I ran to join them in the car, Hema spun on her heels and thrust her face in mine.
"I think you had something to do with this, Merian. I'm not a fool."
She got in the car and slammed the door. They pulled away with Almaz cradling Genet in the back, Ghosh driving. I ran down our drive, cut behind the tool shed and across the field, and caught up with them as they took her into casualty. They poured fluids and antibiotics into Genet's veins. Then Hema took her to Operating Theatre 3 for a more careful examination. When Hema came out, she was shaken but more composed, and quietly furious. She didn't seem to care if I heard her report to Ghosh and Matron.
"Can you imagine Rosina paid to slice off the child's clitoris? Not just clitoris, but also the labia minora and then sew the edges together with sewing thread? Good God, can you imagine the pain? I cut the sutures out. It is hugely infected. Now it's up to God."
Genet was wheeled to the single room reserved for VIPs. I remembered Ghosh telling me it was the room that General Mibratu had occupied after emergency surgery shortly after we were born. I sat on a chair by her bed. At one point, Genet squeezed my hand. Whether consciously or reflexively, I couldn't be sure. I held it. Hema sat across from me in an armchair, her elbows on her knees, head in her hands. We had nothing to say to each other. I was as angry with Hema as she was with me. At one point, Hema lifted her head up and said, "The people who did this should all go to jail." It wasn't the first time she'd had to rescue a woman in Genet's situation. She was probably one of the world's experts in treating botched and infected female circumcisions. But now her face was clamped down in a bitterness I'd never seen before. It was evening when Genet opened her eyes. She saw me, and she tried to say something. I asked her if she wanted water, and she nodded. I guided a straw to her mouth. She looked around to see if there was anyone else in the room.
"I'm sorry, Marion," she whispered, her eyes swimming with tears.
"Don't talk," I said. "It's all right." It wasn't, but that's what came to my mouth.
"I should have waited," she said.
"Why didn't you?" I wanted to say. "I didn't get any of the pleasure, the honor of being your first lover, but I'm getting all the blame." She moaned when she tried to move, licking her lips. I gave her more water.
"My mother thinks it was you."
Her voice was weak. I nodded, but said nothing.
"When I told her it was Shiva," Genet said, "she slapped me. She kicked me and called me a liar. She didn't believe me. She thinks Shiva is a virgin."
She tried to laugh, but grimaced and then coughed. When she could speak, she said,
"Listen, I made my mother promise not to tell Hema."
I couldn't resist a sarcastic snicker. "Well, don't worry. She will tell Hema. She's probably telling her right now."
"No, she won't," Genet said. "That was our deal."
"What do you mean?"
"I agreed to let her do this to me if she wouldn't say anything. She's to keep quiet. Not a word to Hema. Not one word. And no more shouting at you."
I slumped back on hearing this. Genet allowed a strange woman to cut her privates with an unsterilized blade, and it was all to protect me? So now I was to blame for the circumcision? It was so absurd that I wanted to laugh, but I found I couldn't. The guilt had settled on me as if it knew that was its home and it would be welcome. Shiva came in the evening, his face pale and drawn. "Here, sit here," I said, before he could open his mouth. I didn't trust myself near him, and I needed a break. "Stay with her till I come back. Hold her hand. She gets restless when I let go." There was nothing else I could say to him now. I was beyond anger, and he was beyond sorrow. Genet's fever raged for 3 days. I sat by her bed day and night. Hema, Gosh, and Matron were in and out all the time. On the third day, Genet stopped making any urine. Gosh was very worried, drawing blood himself. Then Shiva or I would run to the lab, help WW line up our reagents and tubes, and measure the blood urea nitrogen level. High and getting higher. Genet was never completely unconscious, just sleepy, confused at times, often moaning, and at one point horribly thirsty. She called for her mother once, but Rosina wasn't there. Almaz told me Rosina wouldn't leave her room, which was probably a good thing. The atmosphere in the hospital room was tense enough without the prospect of Hema attacking Rosina. On the sixth day, Genet's kidneys began to produce urine, and then they produced it in huge amounts, filling up the catheter bag. Gosh doubled and tripled her intravenous fluid rates and encouraged her to drink to keep up with the loss. "Hopefully this means her kidneys are recovering," Gosh said. "They just aren't able to concentrate the urine too well." One morning, when I woke up in the chair and saw her face, the texture of the skin, the relaxation around the brow, I knew she was going to make it. She was skinny to begin with, and now the illness had consumed her, burned her down to just bones. Her color was returning. The sword that hung over her had lifted away. My shoulders began to unknot. That afternoon, I went to my room in Ghosh's quarters, and I fell into a black sleep. It was only when I woke up that I turned my attention to Shiva. Did he understand how he shattered my dreams? Did he see how he hurt Genet, hurt us all?